Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Never let it be said that the good staff here at Research on Religion never miss an opportunity to celebrate major historical milestones, because it is usually quite obvious that we do miss major historical milestones all the time. Back in December of 2015, we had a golden opportunity to celebrate and discuss Dignitatis Humanae, a document speaking to religious freedom that was issued at the Second Vatican Council 50 years earlier. Now, 2 months on, we finally get around to it, with today's guest, Dr. Keith Pavlicek, a military affairs expert with a focus on just war theory and the ethics of war, who retired as a colonel in the United States Marine Corps in 2007 after 30 years of active and reserve service. He has served as a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and was also involved in the Civitas program in Faith and Public Affairs at the Center for Public Justice. He was also an assistant professor at Truman State University in the early 1990s and is the author of John Courtney Murray and the Dilemma of Religious Toleration, a book focusing on Catholic arguments for religious freedom that flowed into the Dignitatis Humanae debate and document. And that will be the focus of our discussion today. Keith, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, it's interesting how the guests that we have here often have really interesting backgrounds and get to where they are. And you're a Marine Corps officer who finds the time to complete a doctorate at the University of Pittsburgh. You served abroad in Bosnia, Afghanistan, the U.S. Central Command, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And then you go and write a book on John Courtney Murray, a Jesuit theologian who maintained some relatively controversial views on religious pluralism and liberty for his time. And that, his ideas, greatly influenced Dignitatis Humanae. If you could reconcile all this for me, how does a leatherneck end up writing about a Jesuit?
Well, actually, I served on active duty in the late 70s, early 80s, before I began. That was active duty, and then I actually left active duty, went into the Marine Corps Reserve, and basically during the 1980s, I did a couple master's degrees and a PhD, and I started out with an interest in systematic theology, but gradually found my way with a much greater interest in political theory and moral theology. And So I did a master's degree at Westminster Seminary, where I began to shift my interest towards those areas, doing a master's thesis on a movement called theonomy, taking a very hard theological look at that. And that persuaded me that I wanted to do a PhD and focus on questions of religious liberty. But that was in a religious studies program with a theological emphasis, and basically I began to read around in 20th century Christian ethics on both the Protestant side and the Roman Catholic side into looking at the people that had written on religious liberty. And I wasn't so much interested in the person himself, but I was interested in how they address what I perceived to be a problem in ethics generally, moral philosophy, and so my task was to find what I thought was the one person who struggled with these issues with the most intellectual depth and rigor, and you know, somebody who really struggled, not in a very simplistic way, but really wanted to tackle the hard questions that were at the root of this. And quite frankly, I far and away, the answer to my question was John Courtney Murray. And I honestly thought I'd heard about Murray, and I had read some of his more popular stuff like Rehold These Truths, but my initial suspicion was that he had been well worked over and that there just wasn't much more to say about Murray. But as I began to dig into it, I found that that was, in fact, not the case. Shockingly and incredibly not the case. Very little scholarly work had been done on Murray. And so I settled on a decision to do my work on Murray, and that was what resulted in my book. But that was a long time ago. That was, I think we published the book in 93. It was my doctoral dissertation, and then we published it as a book.
Yeah, still relevant today, because the arguments, as I read through this, are very useful for thinking through religious liberty issues today. And then, as we are on just past the 50th anniversary of Dignitatis Humanae, it's a good time to be reviewing these things. Now, one of the things you mentioned, that you said John Courtney Murray, you thought that he would be worked over quite a bit. And given that I grew up Catholic, I should possibly know the name. John Courtney Murray actually made the cover of Time magazine, but that was well before I was born.
I actually have a picture on I've got that cover matted on my wall. That was my wife gave that to me. I think that might have been either a graduation present or a birthday present. I've got that cover as a very prominently placed on my office at home.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit bad here that I didn't know the guy, and I went to a Jesuit university too, at Marquette University in the early 80s. But did you grow up Catholic? Did you grow up knowing this guy?
No, in fact, this is part of the really interesting part of the story is that, as I mentioned earlier, I wasn't interested in whether person may, I was interested in the argument. The generally applicable arguments. And so I didn't pick Murray because he was a Catholic or not because he was Catholic. As I said, I had read around in Protestant theologians, I'd looked at Reinhold Niebuhr and John Bennett and any number of 20th century Protestant theologians, either mainline or evangelical. And I settled on Murray because, quite frankly, it was very clear that he was struggling with this at an intellectual and scholarly level that was just far and above what anybody else was doing. And as I dug deeper into it, I began to understand broader Catholic context. So anyway, there's more interesting stories to tell about all that, but I do think that the fact that I'm not Catholic gave me a certain distance from I think I said this in the opening book, a certain distance from what I called then the quest for the historical Murray, the fight that was going on in the 80s and 90s over the right to claim the mantle among Catholics of the great John Courtney Murray, right? So liberal, progressive Catholics said, oh, he's ours because he's progressive, and conservative Catholics, oh, no, he's ours. And I wasn't at all interested in that question. I was interested in looking at his writing and his text to understand, where he was coming from, on his own terms. And I think that distance served me very well. It also introduced me to the entire Catholic world, which I was not at all familiar with. So a lot of my a lot of my friends who are Catholic, read the book and they say, oh, who is this guy? It's like this guy is trying to do justice to Murray. you know, rather than just being part of the inner Catholic food fight, as I said.
So. Yeah. Well, we want to talk about Murray here, but before we do that, I would like to start with rewinding history, or actually fast-forwarding history from Murray's time a little bit, and take a look at the document that he had a significant influence over, of, and that's Dignitatis Humanae. We're on the cusp of the 50th anniversary, or we're just past the 50th anniversary, I should say. What is Dignitatis Humanae? What is contained in that document, and why is it important in church and Christian history?
Without getting too detailed, essentially, Dignitatis Humanae made the civil right to religious freedom about as close as you can get to Catholic doctrine. That was quite a move for the Catholic Church. There's no way you can look at, say, the documents that were the papal, even the encyclical documents that were written in the 19th century, and if you looked at those, that you could see where it could be possible that that would eventually grow or develop into, you know, the kind of defense of religious liberty that you got in the 1960s, right? I mean, you had some papal documents, you know, essentially saying it was a kind of a crazy idea, this open notion of religious freedom and a notion of pluralism of religions within a particular polity. So it was, quite frankly, a lot of Catholics try to downplay I'm hesitant to say almost radical nature of Dignitatis Humanae, although there are aspects of it that that aren't so radical. But it's a very important and crucial document of religious liberty in official papal teaching.
Yeah, one of the things that is really radical about the document and relative for the Catholic Church history is that it advocated for seeking truth without any type of coercion. So there wouldn't be necessarily state churches, and you know, throughout the history of Christianity, there has been a number of state churches as well. And it brings up the role of the state to protect and defend religious pluralism and religious liberty.
Yeah, although the document certainly leaves open as permissible a privileging of the Catholic Church. In other words, it wasn't radically disestablishmentarian in that sense. But you're right. It repudiated the slogan that heir has no rights, if by that you mean heir has no civil rights. And that was the slogan that was advanced by conservative Catholics, and not just in Europe, but in the United States as well, and in fact, by the people that had opposed John Courtney Murray in the 1950s, and in fact had him censured by the Vatican.
So let's talk about John Courtney Murray now and back up. We'll roll the tape backwards here a little bit now. And he is a Jesuit priest. He's a theologian. And he's the guy who really starts to move the debate about religious freedom forward probably a couple decades before Dignitatis Humanae. So give us a general background on this John Courtney Murray guy. Who is he?
Murray is, in the first instance, a Trinitarian theologian. The courses he taught at seminary were courses that had to do with Trinitarian doctrine and historical theology. And my impression is that Murray was kind of dragged into the entire church state and religious liberty issue as sort of a side issue. That wasn't where his academic training was, and that's not what, in the first interest, he was most concerned with teaching. He wasn't. He was interested in teaching doctrine of the Trinity and the history and the development of that. doctrine. I mean, and in fact, he wrote a great book, one of the best books he ever wrote, called The Problem of God, where he discusses the, you know, Nicaea and the development of Trinitarian doctrine and the sort and that kind of thing. So my impression is that what really got him going was the early 40s Supreme Court decisions, which seemed to be taking the church in a very strict separationist movement, as well as the rise of a very, very harsh and polemical anti-Catholicism among what I call in the book, you know, sort of liberal or progressive Protestants who were taking a, that was almost a nativist anti-Catholic position. The court case that really set him off was Everson v. Board of Education and the subsequent McCollum decision. It was in reacting to that strict, there's an irony here, right? The secularist, liberal Protestant defense of a radical separation, a radical polemic against Roman Catholics, and particularly surrounding Catholic parochial schools, that set him to the task of working on church-state theory and then towards religious liberty. I think it was probably his concern to defend the right of Catholic parents to educate their children as Catholics in their parochial schools without penalty that started him on this journey.
Yeah, we should note here, too, that John Courtney Murray is an American. He grew up in the Boston, New England area, right?
I think he grew up in Boston. I would have known this on the tip of my tongue years ago, but you know, he spent his adult life down here at Woodstock Theological Seminary in Maryland.
And that becomes an important aspect of his life, too, because here's a Catholic growing up in Protestant United States, so to speak, and in the first half of the 20th century, where you're still seeing a lot of residual anti-Catholicism. And,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you can kind of understand from his vantage point, being a minority faith, that religious pluralism is going to play a big, huge role in his thinking here. And as you mentioned, those court cases really set him off.
And that's very important, because one of the things that I emphasize in my, one of the conclusions that I came to in looking at Murray is that Murray's own positions grow out of two sets of polemics, two arguments. On the one hand, he's arguing against radical secularists and these radical secularists and Protestants of various varieties that were hostile to Roman Catholicism, and particularly when that hostility finds its way into court decisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one argument he's making. The other argument is he's making against traditionalist Catholics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and these were guys that were at Catholic University. They were teaching at, or their journal, from which they launched their attacks on Murray in the early 50s, were from the old American Ecclesiastical Review, which was the, and so Murray would write scholarly articles at Theological Studies, which is a Jesuit journal, and these guys at Catholic U would be writing for the American Ecclesiastical Review. And so Murray is, while he's arguing against the separationists, right, the Americans United for the Protestants and other Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and secularists, Paul Blanchard, he's also arguing against traditionalist Catholics who are arguing for the unity of throne and altar if you can get it. And they were arguing that is, it is incumbent on Catholics to seek, you know, to seek a Catholic society in which the state would privilege and indeed suppress non-Catholic expressions, right?
Yeah.
And so Murray has the task of arguing against them both, and his own position is probably his he's never more clear of what he's doing than when he's arguing against them. But one of my points is that there's because his own view emerges out of those polemics, his own position argument for religious liberty has to be read within that context. So Murray never really sat down and wrote a book-long scholarly article on religious liberty. It was his influence at Vatican II and Dignitas Humanae that became famous, but you have to infer his positions out of the arguments he was making prior to Vatican II against those two positions. Because the traditionalist Catholics, the accusation was, oh, you're just capitulating to Americanism, right? That was a heresy in the late 19th century. And so they accused him of saying, wait a second, the Catholic Church has clearly been teaching all these years this. And Murray's task was to try to show how, no, the American settlement of no establishment and free exercise is perfectly compatible with Roman Catholicism in general and Thomism in particular.
Now, your book is titled John Courtney Murray and the Dilemma of Religious Toleration, and that's one of the first things that he has to wrestle with, and that's one of the first things that you do in your book, too, is about toleration as a conceptual problem. So what is the dilemma that we're talking about here in terms of religious toleration?
Well, it first of all has to do with the notion of toleration, and that there's so much confusion these days over the definition of what it means to tolerate something. You know, and I guess quite simply, I put it like, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the first chapter, I spent a lot of time doing a little philosophy on the notion of what can toleration mean, and why is toleration even a virtue? So the first question is, you know, how do you make sense that toleration is a virtue? Well, it can't be a virtue like the cardinal virtues, because toleration is only a virtue depending on what you want to tolerate. And by tolerate, I mean, even though you disagree with something, an act or an attitude or whatever, that you're willing to leave it be, as it were, permit it, allow it, even though you disagree with it. And a lot of people confuse being tolerant with being indifferent. Well, you're not tolerant of something you're indifferent towards. You're just indifferent toward it. You know, it doesn't make any sense to say, you know, I'm tolerant of somebody who prefers vanilla ice cream to chocolate ice cream. No, it's like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know? But it does make sense to say I'm tolerant of, pick something you strongly disagree with. You know, I'm tolerant of somebody who professes a religion I don't agree with. I believe it's wrong, right? But nevertheless, we'll allow it to be. So actually, if you think about it in those terms, intolerance is a virtue, right? Well, we don't want to tolerate, you know, sexual assault on college campuses. I'm intolerant towards sexual assault on college campuses. Oh, it's a good thing you're intolerant of sexual assault on college campuses, right? Intolerance is a virtue in that situation, right? So, I was always trying to struggle with that in terms of thinking of government, the state, whatever views it adopts, you know, the majority of the people may believe that a certain religion is false or whatever, but they're all, but then provide all kind of reasons for being tolerant of that. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a quick and dirty summary of what I think the dilemma is, because when you get to matters of grave and important moral or religious moral issues, can you ever get to the point where you say, well, we can't be tolerant of that? You know what I'm saying? It's, then why would you not, and if they're grave, and if they're important, why, what are the reasons and justifications for letting, letting it be when you want to see that sort of vision be widely, propagated?
Yeah, this, and when it gets to core religious beliefs, you know, your belief in the one true God and the, you know, if God is Trinitarian or not, those are things that historically have been hard for people to tolerate differences on.
Yeah, and I would say that, I mean, I just say this as a rather factual historical matter. In the West, Protestants came to that much easier than Catholics did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of my study was, when I did my master's thesis, was looking at, for instance, the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the Reformed Presbyterian confession. There's stuff in there about the civil magistrate having, you know, to protect true religion and so this is the 17th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody was sort of like that. What's fascinating is that when in America, in the colonies, at the time of the Revolution, the Presbyterians took a look at the Westminster Confession, and they said, whoa, it's like, we're not for that.
Mm-hmm. You
know, and they just dropped it.
Yeah.
They just dropped it without much fanfare. And same with the Belgic Confession in Holland, and, you know, among the Reformed parties in Holland in the late 19th century. When it came to that stuff about, you know, elders of the church, you know, had authority in matters of religion, and that, you know, you had to be careful because you can't have atheists and Catholics, that kind of thing. They just dropped it.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, you know, it just kind of like faded away. Whereas Catholics, and this, I'm not saying this polemically. I'm just saying, I mean, Catholics into the 19th century, you know, we're still holding on to that throne and altar, unity of throne and altar thing.
Hmm.
And it wasn't until Dignitatis Humanae in the 1960s, and it was a huge struggle. I mean, that's what became very clear to me. It wasn't like just they showed up and boom, you know, Dignitatis. The fighting at Vatican II over Dignitatis Humanae was really intense.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, Murray himself, for arguing with his American Catholic friends at Catholic U and at the American Ecclesiastical Review, they got him censured by the Vatican in 1955. They told him he couldn't write about church state anymore. That's how intense it was. I mean, so Murray is a good Catholic. Just said, okay, I lost. I'm just going to have to shut up. But then the rest of the story is he was actually invited to be a paratist and an expert at Vatican II, and was very much involved from about the third to the fifth draft. Very, very, very influential in what eventually emerged.
Well, let's look at some of his arguments that he made that he was censured for. And you mentioned earlier that he was arguing in contrast to several other arguments rather than necessarily making a new one. So he's building this out of arguing against others. And you talk about in your book a couple different approaches that he was framing his arguments against: the modus vivendi approach, the liberal Protestant perspective, and the secularist approach. Let's go ahead and review each of these on how he viewed them, explain what each of these approaches are, and then explain how Murray argued against them. Let's start with the modus vivendi approach. What is that?
This approach argues that what emerged in the West in terms of pluralism or tolerance of different religious differences was essentially a historical realization that we need to let it be, right? But by let it be, we need to not have an established church and not suppress religion, because it's a settlement, it's a practical settlement that came out of everybody killing each other in early modernity, right? So after the Reformation, everybody was clinging to the notion that a civil polity could only have one religion, right? It was just inconceivable to religious people. Oh, and by the way, secularists as well as people like secular liberals like Rousseau and Hobbes, that you could just have a multitude of different religions. And so the settlement was, it's better to just, you know, have the polity deal with other stuff rather than have people kill each other over, you know, different views of, different theological views, like, you know, the nature of the Eucharist or certain ecclesiastical authorities and that kind of thing. So that argument says that what eventually merged was just that realization. And, you know, we learned the hard way after a century or two of bloody war, and that's what emerged. And so that argument would say that all these philosophical arguments about, you know, grounding religious liberty in whatever is just kind of a waste of time, right? So that's one sense in which it's a modus vivendi. And there's another sense, too, in which the position that Murray was opposing among conservative Catholics was kind of a modus vivendi. So he would look at conservative Catholics. Now, conservative Catholics, or traditionalist Catholics, or whatever label you want to put to those folks, they weren't saying, oh, we're obliged to have an established church in America today, and it ought to be Catholic. No. Their argument was, well, yeah, we understand that this is a settlement, right? And that we're happy for, you know, we're happy for the freedom that Catholics now have, but we should be working for a Catholic society that when finally Catholics become overwhelmingly, once society becomes overwhelmingly Catholic, we should be able to have an established church, and we should be able to put restrictions and even suppress non-Catholic religions. That was called the thesis hypothesis. So the thesis was that a Catholic state and a Catholic society, and the hypothesis was, you know, that we don't have that now, but we should work to that. And they resisted efforts to say that no, that is the situation you describe as possible should never even be, you know, even in a situation like that, there should be, you know, tolerance or full religious freedom. And they resisted that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In fact, it resonates a lot with me, since my most recent book deals with an approach similar to that. I look at the trajectory of religious liberty in the United States and see it as a very pragmatic outcome to everybody agreeing not to kill one another, to free trade with one another, to allow immigration from different folks. So I can see that argument floating out there. And
Murray, and I don't think, you know, I don't want to go into all the nuances, but I try to tackle those nuances at the founding. See, at the founding, you know, Murray maybe tried to struggle with that himself. I don't think he ever resolved how did the First Amendment emerge? Did it emerge from a philosophical liberalism, like where they were proto John Rawls philosophy? No, I mean, my own sense is that, yeah, there was the fact that, you know, you had Presbyterians who finally come to, they're very influential, and they were for a separation of the civil authority and the Baptists, et cetera. But, and that is what eventually why they eventually settled on the First Amendment, which was a restriction on the federal government establishing religion and allowing free exercise. But it didn't even reach to the states, right? The states still had establishments. And, in fact, the states could privilege their own establishments, right? So the federal government didn't come out by the First Amendment and say and outlaw establishments. That only kind of came later, and it developed precisely for the, as I suspect you know, it developed because people just got tired of paying their money to the Episcopalians or the Congregationalists, right? The Baptists and the Methodist circuit riders said, wait a second here. And so, it's like they outvoted them.
Yeah. So that's the modus vivendi case. And I imagine that Murray is arguing against this because he doesn't want to just rest his theological foundations for tolerance of religious pluralism on, well, that's how history turned out. He wants to basically embed it in some kind of moral foundation that has more permanence.
Right. And remember what's motivating him. Excuse my French, but the nativists and the secularists are kicking the hell out of the Catholics because they know what they're saying, right? They're saying, yeah, the Catholics are going to try to take over, right? In a sense, there's something to that. They're saying, hey, you Catholics are only for religious liberty until you get control. Just look at what those guys over at the American Ecclesiastical Review are saying, right? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Murray is trying to argue for the rights of religious of Catholic parents to raise their kids as Catholics, and maintain a little stinking tax credit, right? So, and of course, as I said, Murray picked this up in the 40s in the Supreme Court decisions. That he was appalled. I mean, it was just appalling. He wrote some of the most brilliant articles, right, against those Supreme Court decisions. But this was 20 years after Pierce v. Society of Sisters in 1920, as well as some other court decisions, in which essentially there was a movement, an interesting movement. Coalition of very progressives and Klansmen in Oregon to prohibit Catholic parents from sending their kids to parochial schools. It would essentially shut down parochial schools. Would have made them illegal, right? And of course, that was struck down in the great case of Pierce v. Society of Sisters, right? So Murray is smart enough to know that he's got to try to deflect that that kind of polemic. And so that's what I mean when I say Murray's fighting a two-front battle here, to his left and his right, He turns to his right or his left, however you want to say that, and he just destroys people like John Blanchard. He writes these articles, a brilliant article about the Everson decision. He takes on Americans United for what it was then called, Americans United for a Separation of Church and State. And so he's arguing against secularists and liberal Protestants who are making these anti-Catholic arguments. But then he's turning around to the traditionalist Catholics, and that's where his scholarship and his historical scholarship becomes. It's polemical, but it's very, that's where it becomes very scholarly and historic. He's writing historical theology, when he's trying to go to the history, and development of Catholic political thought and is making an argument that the American understanding of church and state is perfectly consonant with, medieval and pre-Reformation Catholic thought, and is trying to argue that the throne and altar position, or the thesis hypothesis position, of his traditionalist Catholic opponents is actually a modern, a more modern development. That's a very complex argument. I'm still not. I mean, Murray was so, so much. Here's the deal. Murray was so much smarter than these guys. I mean, he was just brilliant. I mean, it's like somebody was just looking outside, and I'm just saying, oh man, Murray is just so sharp and brilliant that I think he was one of the arguments, and I think they were so upset with him that they ran to the Vatican and got him essentially shut up.
Yeah, and ironically brought him to the attention of the Vatican, then gets him an invitation to Vatican Council too, which is
that's a good point. But it was it was the American cardinal, I forget his name, that actually pulled him into Vatican II. Because he did. I mean, Murray wrote "We Hold These Truths" in 1960, right? And yeah, he was censured, but yeah, he could. It was a collection of early. I don't think there was any essay in that book that hadn't been published in the 60s or the 50s, I think. So yeah, he was censured, but he still wrote "We Hold These Truths." And before you know, and then of course he's on the cover of Time magazine. So everybody knew, you know, John Craig Murray was famous in 1960, and so it wasn't very difficult for the famous cardinal from New York was the one that brought him in as a paratus or an expert at Vatican II.
And that time that book came out, "We Hold These Truths," was a very important time for those of you in the audience who might not have historical memory. That was the time of the election of John F. Kennedy. And so this issue of, you know, Catholics, what happens if you elect a Catholic? Are we going to get the papacy in the United States becomes really huge.
Oh, let me say something about that.
Yeah.
Now, after, you know, in the years since I've written the book, you know, I've been able to have a number of discussions with Catholics. And I'm going off memory here. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where, you know, I dare you all to go find a footnote to prove this. But I can say with about 95% certainty that John Courtney Murray voted for Richard Nixon in 1960, which is ironic, right? Here you've got an Irish Catholic and he's not, you know, he's not real hot on JFK. And the reason he's not hot on JFK is because JFK goes down to Houston and basically makes the same kind of separationist argument, right, that he recognizes was the kind of thing made by the anti-Catholics, right? You know, I won't ever let my religion influence my politics, you know? So, I mean, that's a certain irony there, and it tells you where Murray was coming from. So, anyway, I wish I could remember off my head where I had been told or I had read that, but I've never chased that down. But I'm pretty confident about that.
Some for some other folks to chase down. I'm curious about that because it probably leads into some of these other arguments for religious toleration that he was arguing against, the liberal Protestant case and also the secularist case. I can see where Kennedy is making this secularist case that's probably bleeding into liberal Protestant cases wherein, you know, just put your religion and keep it at home or in, you know, the church on Sunday, but don't bring it out to the public squares. Are those arguments?
Yeah, but of course that's all within a context. You see, and this is, I pushed this a bit. That's all within a context in which you've got a broad moral consensus, right? Broadly moral consensus. That's in fact a broadly Christian consensus. And in a context like that, you know, worry about fighting in public square over theological issues, right? But once that broad Protestant, and they would see it as a broadly Protestant consensus, collapses, well, then what becomes the glue that holds the society together, right? I mean, that's another part of the dilemma, right? You know, it can't, and so Murray knew that. Murray, particularly at the end of his life, says, you know, he talked about, you know, the barbarians in Brooks Brothers suits, like, who have no common moral vision of society. And he called John Locke that most decadent of all philosophical things, anomalous. So, I mean, Murray, this is why Murray is, at the end of the day, not anything approaching a progressive or a liberal. What we call today very conservative, because he believed that there had to be a moral consensus. He believed that had to be a broadly Christian consensus, and he bemoaned into the 60s the loss and the collapse of that consensus among what we now call the Protestant mainline. He could see it becoming unraveling, right? It was unraveling in the 60s, and so the other thing to remember is that what we now know, the emergence of evangelicalism, it just wasn't a part of his universe. Like, he did, evangelicalism, you know, it's like the conservative Protestant. These weren't the people that were engaged at very high levels of government. It was like, so Murray could only see Protestantism as sort of the big mainline, you know, and he didn't know what was going on sort of underneath the radar. I mean, if you ask Murray about, you know, evangelicals or Pentecostals or the rising, you know, it's like Carl, he wouldn't know anything about that. You know, he's kind of in his Catholic world, right? So when he looks out, he sees Protestants, and he sees on the one hand, a lot of them are like, they're adopting the nativism of the Paul Blanchard types, you know, strict separationist stuff, you know. And what he does is he's very able to expose their own assumptions, right, as relying on a certain moral consensus that maybe not everybody approves, but or agrees with. So he sees that. He bemoans the collapse of a Protestant, even though he's not Protestant, he bemoans the loss of that consensus and the crack-up there. And that's really begins to get at the problem, because you need, he believed in order to maintain the American experiment, you had to have a certain moral consensus. Now, so he's saying, you know, we need to have a plurality of religious views and allow them to flourish. But he says, quite frankly, that it's not clear whether we can survive the lack of a moral consensus. Right? And so, but then the question is, and I pressed hard on that, and I'm not sure I have the answer, is how can you maintain that moral consensus if you don't have at least have something like a religious theological consensus?
Yeah, one of the cases that you make later in your book about how Murray grounds his own moral foundation on this, basically trying to not rely upon a secularist, oh, we just all have to tolerate each other so we don't kill each other, but grounded in some kind of moral foundation, is this concept of subsidiarity. And it's one of my favorite Catholic concepts. Explain how he uses subsidiarity to build his case for religious pluralism and toleration.
Yeah, and I would have to go back in detail to take another look at how much he drives that home, but generally subsidiarity has to do with, I think, the really key point that Murray does emphasize, and that's the notion of a limited state, right? So a limited state that respects the non-governmental institutions of the civil society, right? Family, church, etc. Seeks to push down to the lowest level of decision making the decisions are left to those various organizations and societal structures, right? With the government, the state, being a matter of sort of last resort. I'm not so sure. So I think his notion of subsidiary and Catholic, he clearly understood that. But even more fundamental to that was the notion that there were, Murray kept coming back to the notion of what he called the Galician dualism. It was like two there are, not one there is. That is, there's a duality of orders, which meant that the state, by definition, was limited. And in fact, at the end of the day, his argument for religious liberty is based on the notion that there was a duality of authorities. I would have to go back and just see how hard Murray pushes on subsidiarity. But of course, his Catholic opponents, his traditionalist Catholic opponents, also believe in subsidiarity. But see, that didn't prevent them from taking a different tack or understanding of religious liberty. I'm rambling a bit, but I think what Murray was getting at, and what I think subsequent development of Murray's work should be, is that if you're going to be faithful to the doctrine of subsidiarity, you can't have a state have so much authority, right, that it's going to be in a position of suppressing the religious opinions held, right, by different groups in society, right. If you're gonna be true to the doctrine of subsidiarity, you need to let these organizations spring up from below, as it were. So to form organizations that come out of their deepest religious and moral convictions.
Let me finish up with a question here. You wrote your book on John Courtney Murray some two decades ago, coming out of your dissertation, and you've had a lot of time to reflect about this. A lot of things have happened since that period of time. So looking back at your research and thinking about the history over the last two or three decades or so, how would you categorize your research and what you understand now? How would you reconcile history now? If you wrote a follow-up to your book, what might you include today?
The one aspect that I just mentioned it a second ago, that I think I would want to push harder on, is the distinction that Murray kept drawing. He kept appealing to the Galician dualism, that there are two orders. And for the longest time, it was one of those things where, yes, of course, but why is that important? And I said, okay, I get it. I understand what he's doing. But what has really forced me to understand how important that is to the development of religious freedom and a pluralistic state in the West is the rise of Islamism and Islamic movements. I think it's only in contrast to what possible alternatives there are to that, that you begin to understand what he was getting at, and more profoundly, what is different about the Christian understanding of state and society, if you can put it that way, which is dualistic, and a Islamic notion which whose trajectory is monistic. And this comes up, I think, begins to get at the distinction between Christian and Islamic notions of religious liberty. The basic point is this, that no matter, even understanding all the fights in the West, right, and the different understandings of how the secular and sacred authorities relate to each other, whether it's Augustine's two cities, whether it's how it's reflected in medieval Christendom, like the Galatian dualism, how it comes to fruition in the Reformation, distinction between the elders of the church and the civil magistrate, even how it comes to fruition in the American Republic, right, between separation, you know, between church and state, and even in I would say heretical secularist notions of distinctions between church and state. The baseline is that there's a duality there, right, that has to be struggled with. And how do you relate the two swords? How do you relate the two kingdoms, Luther's two kingdoms? How do you relate the two cities? My suspicion is, and I'm not an Islamic authority, but I've read enough around people who are, and you get this in Lewis, that there is not that's a Western notion. That's a Western Christian notion, right? That there are these competing authorities, whereas the trajectory in Islamic culture is towards a monism, of which there's one, mm-hmm. right? Which is why, you know, the question keeps popping up. You know, it's like, Islam doesn't seem to be anywhere, you know, doesn't seem to be open to, you know, full flowering of religious liberty, and they're hostile to it. You know, there was a great resistance, for instance, to the UN Declaration of Human Rights, et cetera, et cetera. People say, well, but the Catholics were too, up until Vatican II. It took till the 1960s for the Catholics to figure this out. Yeah, don't worry, Islam will figure it out as well. And I'm pessimistic about that, and the reason I'm pessimistic about that is because I don't think they have that duality to appeal to. It tends to be more monistic in its understanding of the state, and hence it's going to bring it back to subsidiarity, or in the Reformed tradition, the notion of sphere sovereignty. You know, the state will subsume those non-state institutions, particularly if they start to get, you know, out of line in terms of their religious beliefs. So, I mean, if I were still doing scholarship and I were still in academia, I'd want to start to ask real hard questions along those lines. And it's actually the Galatian dualism, although Murray does it over and over and over again. When I wrote the book, you know, I said, okay, I get it, and I've got a section on that, but I think I would probably be more appreciative now of just how unique that is. And I think I was blind to it because you don't see the alternative, right? So that's, I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's where I probably want to push a lot more. And then I'd want to really go back, and toward the end of the book, Murray got very, after Vatican II, very, very pessimistic. He talked about the the rise of the new barbarians, and that the new, he called it the new tribalism, and he was very pessimistic about whether American society could stay together given the, you know, the collapse, the collapse that he thought he saw all around him. And I think, and he actually died too early to develop that thought, but I always saw a very, you know, here's Murray. He comes out of Vatican II and he's a great hero, right? He wins the day. He gets what he wants. He should be optimistic, but he's not. You know, so it wasn't like Murray was one of these new post-Vatican II hippy-dippies. He was appalled by what he saw. He was appalled by what he was seeing was happening to his Jesuits. I mean, he was not happy. Which is why when I hear Catholics, the more progressive Catholics, try to claim him, I just say, it's like, that's not the Murray I'm reading.
Well, there are some interesting thoughts here to be thinking about as we move into future decades, and the thought of John Courtney Murray still remains very relevant for today, and your book, John Courtney Murray and the Dilemma of Religious Toleration, is something that everybody should check out. My guest today has been Keith Pavlicek. Keith, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.